Deadlines. Atari Amir Sheikh Tamim is in Tehran on a one-day state visit for talks with President Raisi. Palestinians pay tribute to veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli occupation forces while reporting an army raid. And a new report sheds light on hundreds of Native American children who died of various forms of abuse and punishment at U.S. state-run boarding schools. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: a short while ago, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi officially welcomed Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani at the Sadabad complex in Tehran. Sheikh Tamim is paying a one-day state visit to Iran's capital at the head of a high-ranking political and economic delegation. The two officials are currently holding a meeting, which will be followed by a press conference. Meetings with other senior Iranian officials have also been scheduled. The visit comes in response to a trip by President Raisi to Doha 3 months ago. The enhancement of bilateral ties as well as major regional and international issues of concern will be at the heart of the discussions. Sheikh Tamim last visited Tehran in January 2020. Senior geopolitical advisor Alexander Ozadegan says the Qatari Emir's trip to Tehran is a positive step in promoting mutual relations.
This has been the strategic goal of Iran for several years now. Iran wants the U.S. out of the Persian Gulf. But the problem is that the region's biggest military base happens to be in Qatar, and Turkey is also there as well. Iran has always said that we should get together all these Persian Gulf countries and the Sea of Oman countries, that being Oman, obviously. Let's get together. Let's not bring foreigners into this place. Now, China really wants to get into the Persian Gulf region. That's another issue. But the Iranians, in my assessment, have been giving not just the Qataris, but the big country of Saudi Arabia, the green lights. Foreign Minister Dr. Zarif always said that Iran is under no illusion that Saudi Arabia should also play a leadership role in this area. Now, back to a question with the Iranian president. When you have the king of the Emir of Qatar visiting Tehran, that's basically an indication that all other negotiations are bagged. Usually when they send in the dignitaries of the highest echelon, that means things for most part are have been negotiated positively, and the presence of the Qatari Emir in Tehran or President Raisi in any of these other Persian Gulf countries is a good positive sign.
A state memorial service has been held at the presidential compound in Ramallah for a Palestinian journalist a day after Israeli forces killed her. A huge crowd of mourners paid their last respects to Shirin Abu Akleh, who was shot in the face by Israeli snipers while covering an army raid in Jenin on Wednesday. Her body lay in state at the compound as a host of officials, including President Mahmoud Abbas, as well as people from all walks of life, paid homage to the veteran journalist. The funeral service is scheduled for Friday. The murder of Abu Akleh has sparked an outpouring of condolences and condemnations, as well as calls for a thorough investigation to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Israeli forces have killed a renowned international journalist in the occupied West Bank. Al Jazeera reporter Shirin Abu Akleh was shot dead on Wednesday. She was killed while reporting on an Israeli raid against Palestinians in the city of Jenin. Violence has surged in Jenin in recent weeks as Israeli forces have stepped up operations in the area after a spate of deadly retaliatory attacks targeting Israelis. Abu Akleh was a very well-respected journalist who has been working with Al Jazeera since the beginning of the Second Palestinian Intifada in 2000.
And the shooting of this journalist is just to cover up their crimes, to show what they were, to not allow the people of the world to see the kinds of things they were doing with this raid in Jenin and many other instances. They didn't only kill this journalist, but they wounded a second journalist.
The Palestinian Health Ministry also said another journalist sustained a gunshot wound to the back. The Associated Press said the Palestinian journalist working for the Al-Quds newspaper was in stable condition. The International Federation of Journalists has described the killing as a deliberate, systematic targeting of a journalist and is planning to submit the case to the International Criminal Court. Yet again, journalists wearing press vests clearly identified were targeted by Israeli snipers. We will seek to add this case to the ICC complaint submitted by the IFJ detailing such systematic targeting. And the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate has decried Abu Akleh's death as a clear assassination perpetrated by the Israeli occupation army.
And they killed this journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, by shooting her in the face. That's just a terrible thing to do. They didn't have to do anything like that. It's a brutal way of acting. It doesn't show any care to human life. It is a very a terrible thing, and it needs to be condemned by the whole world.
Iran has also harshly condemned the killing, saying the case highlights Israel's brutal treatment towards journalists and media outlets.
This is not the first time that a Palestinian reporter has been killed by Israeli forces. During the March of Return protests that were held in 2018 and 19, Palestinian journalists were regularly targeted to prevent them from reporting the Israeli gunfire towards fellow Palestinians. Time and time again, Israeli forces have killed Palestinian civilians, including journalists and medics, without cause, and they do that with impunity as if they were above international law.
Meanwhile, a Qatari official has harshly lashed out at Israel over the incident, calling for an end to, quote, state-sponsored Israeli terrorism. The Palestinian resistance group Hamas condemned in the strongest terms what it called the premeditated murder. It said the world and all international institutions must condemn the heinous crime against the press and free speech and hold the Israeli regime accountable. It further noted that this crime will not succeed in preventing the role of the media and free journalists in conveying the truth, the reality of the Israeli occupation, its brutality, terrorism, and the crimes against the Palestinian people, land, and holy sites.
There's going to be a lot of anger among Palestinians, and there will be more conflict and more fighting because of it, and there will probably be some resistance that will be met very harshly by Israel, which is financed to a large extent and given a lot of military aid by the United States. So they have weapons that Palestinians can't in any way match.
Yet Israel has another belief on what has occurred. The Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has said, according to the information we have gathered, it appears likely that armed Palestinians who were firing indiscriminately at the time were responsible for the unfortunate death of the journalist. In a statement, Al Jazeera called on the international community to hold Israeli forces accountable for the intentional targeting and killing of its journalist.
But it's not the only thing. There is right now a case that has been filed with the International Criminal Court against Israel for the shooting of four journalists in this past year alone. And Israel has actually shot 46 journalists since the year 2000. So this is just the continuation of a brutal policy.
This is not the first time Israel has killed a journalist. The regime systematically targets Palestinian journalists, and with the deliberate killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, Israel has now killed over 45 Palestinian journalists since the year 2000.
A new report shows more than 500 Native American children have died in U.S. government-run boarding schools over a period of more than a century. The Department of Interior's report says indigenous children were exposed to physical abuse, food denial, and other forms of punishment. In state-run boarding schools, it says the school system pursued the twin goals of cultural assimilation and territorial dispossession of indigenous peoples through relocation of their children. The study identified more than 400 such schools operating in the U.S. for 1.5 centuries, starting in the early 19th century. There are also more than 50 marked or unmarked burial sites. The deaths of 500 indigenous students were attributed to only 19 schools that have been investigated so far. The department says further investigation may increase the number of student deaths to thousands or even tens of thousands. Finland is expediting its plans to join NATO. The country says it will apply for membership without delay. President Sauli Niinisto and Prime Minister Sanna Marin have said in a statement that the national steps needed to make the decision will be taken rapidly. Over the next few days, a special committee will announce Finland's formal membership bid on Sunday. Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto says Finland's accession to NATO will strengthen security in the Baltic Sea region. Sweden is also likely to follow suit. Sources inside the EU say NATO allies are expecting Finland and Sweden to be granted membership quickly. Russia has repeatedly warned the two European Union member states against the bid. It sees NATO enlargement as a direct threat to its own security. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen leveling some harsh criticism at Russia and calling it a big threat to international order.
And this brings me to Russia. It is today the most direct threat to the world order. With a barbaric war against Ukraine and its worrying pact with China and their call for new and very much arbitrary international relations.
The European Commission chief was speaking after meeting Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida along with European Council President Charles Michel. Kishida also said the Ukraine war is not just a matter that concerns Europe, but it shakes the core of the international order, including Asia. The top EU officials are in Tokyo for an annual round of talks that come with much of the international community rallying to pressure Moscow over the Ukraine war. The European Commission proposes to establish a new EU agency to tackle the growing problem of child sex abuse in the 27-nation bloc. Unveiling the plans, the Commission says reports of such abuse in the EU have increased by 6,000% during the past decade. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Many believe the crime of sexually abusing a child is even more heinous than murder. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, says 85 million child sex abuse videos and images were identified by the bloc's authorities last year, a record number.
In the EU, the reports related to the European Union member states have increased with 6,000% the last 10 years. Why is this increasing? Of course, nobody knows for sure.
The Commission says it's not known exactly why these crimes are on the rise, but analysts say the EU has been allowed to expand too quickly, with some nations harbouring criminal gangs.
And now, of course, thanks to or due to open borders, are these criminal networks, they started to flourish and integrate further.
The EU Commission is proposing to establish a new agency designed to prevent child sex abuse and support victims.
At least 1 in 5 children falls victim to sexual violence during childhood in Europe. So these numbers are really embarrassing.
Anti-trafficking agencies say 2 million children recently entered the EU having fled the conflict in Ukraine, many of them unaccompanied. Gangs and individuals see an opportunity for exploitation.
The police and child protection services need to work together. Plus, they need to work together across borders, and there need to be better information sharing platforms.
The European Commission has a message for predators.
We are coming for you.
But critics are asking why more has not been done up to now. Given that it promotes itself as a project designed to protect and improve the lives of citizens, rights groups say this issue seriously undermines the credibility of the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new poll shows that the average French person's life is being drastically impacted by runaway inflation. Coming after years of far-right economic austerity, the French economy now appears on the brink of major trouble. Rami Mazuri has more from Paris.
France is a nation of 67 million people, and 40 million of them earn less than 2,000 euros per month. A new poll reveals that skyrocketing inflation is wreaking unprecedented havoc on their lives. The poll says that after bills are paid, 20 million Frenchmen have less than 100 euros in the bank by the 10th of each month. It's not a new problem. Perhaps the primary slogan of the Yellow Vest movement has been a cry of the end of the month.
For us delivery drivers, the price of gas has put us in a very difficult condition. I spent almost 60% more on petrol than I used to, and every day now. Of course, it's not just petrol. Everything else has gotten more expensive too. The state has to lower taxes.
A stunning 95% of those earning less than 2,000 euros per month are worried about inflation. Two-thirds say they are struggling to get by. Half say they have insomnia over financial worries. And 80% of households with children fear they will fall into poverty.
Everything is more expensive, and all my friends and I talk about it. Even the cost of something basic, like cooking oil, has gotten dramatically more expensive. We hope things will somehow get better, but for now, things are quite tight.
New official data says prices will jump 5.4% in June, in the largest monthly increase since 1985. The next 2 months will also see further increases, and combined with near-recession levels of economic growth. After years of no-strings-attached quantitative easing and zero-interest-rate policies for the rich, interest rates are now being hiked just when the average person most needs some credit. The failure to invest years of this so-called free money into societally productive investments means the real economy has suffered from long-running neglect at the expense of high finance, real estate, and stocks. Deeply unpopular austerity cuts have also worsened the condition of the real economy, put even more costs on the average person's back, and left France poorly equipped for what seems like the latest Western financial crisis. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The Spanish government is shaken by a deepening scandal over the use of Israeli Pegasus spyware to hack the cell phones of pro-independence leaders of Catalonia. The same scandal has already engulfed other European states as well, dealing blows to people's trust in their governments. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organisation Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and a corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system, which sent speeding tickets right to your home. 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media embedded behind police lines portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me. People like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film. And I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking and that it was done with smartphones?
Exactly, yeah. It's shot on cameras. The fly, and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get those. What it has and what really is its strength is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine. But they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that was its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I felt there could have been a little bit more to show how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of the Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you're plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on, there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. Mm-hmm. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said?
Absolutely.
Do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. There's a lot in that. There's a lot in, let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's mm-hmm. certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris, and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Mm. Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator says that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protesters and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, you know, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you. And that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mm. mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It would have been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to... was trying to converse with a police officer, mm-hmm. he says,
join
take your
side.
Helmet off,
yes.
come and talk to us.
Yeah,
and I'd like to see more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. Or yeah, I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they, you know, that they, one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest or versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, you know, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest, and sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, you know, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, yeah, violence, of course this should happen. It said, well, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and you know, they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens
indeed.
Them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovi so, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We were talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, you know, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
Mm. And Maurice, what about, what did you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, you know, changing the mayor and, you know, removing the radar cameras. And that
some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that you know, they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. Mm-hmm. There was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
Yeah. And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protest? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from, if I'm honest, a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, I know, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. When it does come to expenditure, when it does come to spending, when it comes to anything else that we're doing as far as our financial obligations are concerned, we need to remember that one pivotal characteristic that we always need to have, and that is balance. Be happy with what we have. Be satisfied with what we have, because it really is never, never ending. You know, you could buy a little boat and then say, well, I'd rather have a larger boat, and then I'd rather have a yacht, and then I'd rather have that, and rather have that. And, you know, you can get up to the stage where you can purchase a $500 million boat, you know. But when does it stop? It won't stop, because that level of tamah and greed is always going to be something pushed by shaitan. Unfortunately, it's a very important point here. Sometimes we mentally justify them as well. Well, you know, if it's my money, it's my halal, you know, I can treat myself to these things every once in a while. But at the end of the day, you know, is it really worth it? You know, are you contributing in a good way? Is it going to make you a better person? Yes, it will give you some kind of satisfaction when you look into the mirror, but that satisfaction won't last very long, you know. Unfortunately, we can see that that level of misery that these kind of people will always have, because they're always going to want more and seek more. As we said, that greed is also, of course, very dangerous, but stinginess is also very bad as well, you know, where a person doesn't spend anything. Bukhl, a bakhil person. As Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, al-bakhil alladhi ya'kul wa la yu'ti. Bakhil is someone who always wants, someone who always eats, but never feeds, never gives. Imam al-Askari salamullahi alayhi, Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, in spending or in stingy spending or becoming bakhil, he says, لِلْإِقْتِصَادِ مِقْدَارًا, for you to be a muqtasid, for you to be financially responsible, for you to economize. Someone who economizes is very important. فَمَا زَادَ عَلَيْهِ فَهُوَ بُخْلٌ, anything beyond being economic is a level of stinginess, a level of بُخْل. لَيْسَ Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, لَيْسَتْ لِبَخِيلٍ رَاحَ. Subhanallah. A bakhil is never comfortable, always counting his or her money, always worried about losing the money, always scared about being put in a predicament where they're going to have to spend that money. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that money is never accumulated through except by two means, illa an bukhlin aw haram, except through greed, through stinginess, or through haram means. Laysat li bakhilin raha, subhanallah. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, al bakhilu ba'idun min Allah. Bakhil is far away from Allah. Wa ba'idun min al jannah. Far away from Jannah, ba'idun min al-nas, even people hate a bakhil person. Far away from people, qareebun min al-nar, and close to hellfire.
Ayatollah Javadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
Imam
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Then we have the topic of Israf. And I've mentioned the topic of Israf before. And again, having that balance, not wasting what it is that you have. Yes, you can afford to buy a large plate of food and only eat one third of it, but the rest goes to waste. That's haram. Being careless about what it is that you are buying. You know, unfortunately, some people, especially when it comes to food, I'd like to speak about that, especially when it comes to the topic of foods, people waste too much food. And that's israf. And that is really, really, really damaging spiritually, socially, morally. And you will be responsible. We will be responsible and accountable for every piece of food that we throw to waste. Imam Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi, he says, Adna al-Israf, the least kind of Israf, the lowest level of Israf, Hiraqatu fadlil ina, is for you to throw away the remaining water that is in a container. Like, there's this level of water, well, I'm just going to throw it away. That itself is a form of israf. وَإِبْتِذَالُ ثَوْبِ الصَّوْنِ وَإِلْقَاءُ النَّوَى. And a second kind of israf, a second or the lowest kind of israf, is for you to spend too much on clothing. In as far as expenditure is concerned, going after luxury items. Continuing us on with this, it's all, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions, it's all to do with you remembering fuqara, for you to remembering the underprivileged, and for you to always keep in mind that, you know, there will come a time where you're going to need these kind of things. Another thing is, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to block barakatu sama for you. You won't have that level of self-discipline, self-awareness, self-progress, self-excelling, because your one and only concern is for you to spend, especially on things that are not going to be on any kind of usage. Here, there is the hadith that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions, and that is su'ul tadbir, bad management, bad financial management. If you, for example, earn an income of 100 dinars a week, and your main focus is on buying a purse that costs 90 dinars, why? Why are you spending 90 dinars and leaving behind 10 dinars? If you earn 100 dinars a week, have good management. Say, well, I'm going to spend 40 dinars on, I'm just saying, using the word dinar, dirham, whatever currency that you're using. I'm going to spend 40 dinars on my house utilities, on bills and things like that. 20, 30 dinars on food and trips and things like that, and I'm going to save the rest. You know, that's a kind of good management. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.